Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine today takes us to Portland and USM for the Frank M. Coffin Lecture on Law and Public Service. The speaker is Mary Bonato, Civil Rights Project Director at GLAAD, who has been at the center of the movement toward same-sex marriage in America for more than two decades. Earlier this year, Bonato successfully argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in the historic case establishing the freedom to marry for same-sex couples nationwide. This program can be heard on our website, mpbn.net, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast.
Thank you, Harvey. I think I'm probably still blushing. Thank you for that generous introduction and for also reminding us about Judge Coffin and his deep humanity and commitment to public service. Now, tonight I'm going to talk about equality and the supposedly impossible, climbing the arc of justice. And I'm going to use the story of achieving marriage equality for same-sex couples to describe that arc. The lessons, I hope, that we learn from this story can teach us how to keep fighting for justice on so many other fronts. I am also going to tell you portions of this story from my own personal perspective. I'm not going to say each time, hey, I did that or I did this, but a lot of it is personal experience. And I want to give you a sense of the reality on the ground in fighting for LGBT equality. And some of that will be the highs, and some of that will also be the lows. So I want to say I did start my career here in Portland with then the firm Middle & Heffernan, and now Middle Aysen. I had the joy of working with truly excellent lawyers with a public interest bent who let me do a lot of pro bono work, and they taught me so much. I will always be grateful. But in 1989, I had the opportunity of a lifetime. There was a staff attorney job opening at Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders in Boston, a New England-wide advocacy group, and I thought, how can I not apply for this? It was a crossroads for sure. It was a significant career decision. People thought I was throwing away my career. But even with sorrow at leaving my treasured colleagues, it wasn't a close call. I wanted to do the social justice work. And with the full support of Jennifer Riggins, now a professor at Maine Law, I took the job. And I am grateful to Jenny, to our daughters, our extended families, the GLAAD family, all of our friends and others in the community who have supported me and this work. Now, I want to say that I have long believed something that Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't say out loud that I know of until 1996. And it was in a case about the Virginia Military Institute admitting women. And she said, the history of our Constitution is the story of extending constitutional rights and protections to those once ignored or excluded. We are living participants and witnesses to that journey for LGBT people. In the several decades before I and others even started working on marriage, we were trying to secure the most basic rights for LGBT people, and our journey was to climb the arc of justice. So let's take Maine as an example. In 1977, under the leadership of now-deceased Portland Representative Larry Connolly and Bangor's Jerry Talbot, the first sexual orientation amendments to the Maine Human Rights Act were introduced into the legislature. Lois Reckitt, who is here tonight, came out as a lesbian at a public hearing in 1979, and it took enormous courage to do so, testifying on behalf of the amendment. Most people dared not show themselves in a context where gay people were referred to as vacuum cleaners of disease. In 1984, Charlie Howard, a young man who fled from a small town to the big city of Bangor, was beaten up and then thrown off a bridge into a stream by three high school students because he was a fag. The boys ignored Charlie's pleas that he could not swim. Charlie's death and the larger community's rallying behind the three students, illustrated, for example, by the Camden Herald editorial, saying it was too bad the boys had been caught, was a warning to all gay people. Still, there were brave souls who held a candlelight vigil in Bangor at a church and marched to the bridge the next night, fearful the whole time of being shot. In the wake of this tragedy, Dale McCormick, now a former state senator and former state treasurer, with Ellie Goldberg, Harry Gordon, Diane Elsey, Robin Lambert, and John Preston, formed the Maine Lesbian and Gay Political Alliance in 1984 to advocate in the legislature and the public square for what they proudly called lesbian and gay civil rights. Things did change with time. In 1993, a non-discrimination bill passed in the state legislature, only to be vetoed by Governor Jock McKernan. Our work towards basic non-discrimination protections continued for another 12 years, including 4 trips to the ballot box. Finally, with a November 2005 vote, Maine had an enforceable non-discrimination law. During much of this time, I was working my dream job at GLAAD, helping these types of efforts in Maine and across New England. We had real passion for our work and for educating the public by shining a light on real people and telling the truth about our lives. Optimistic as I was, despite fairly bleak circumstances back at that time, I still felt there were limits. And when I received a call at GLAAD in 1990 asking me to take up a marriage case for a couple who had been together 10 years, I said no. I thought marriage equality for same-sex couples was required under our state and federal constitutions, but I believed it was the wrong time to make those arguments, and I had to say no many more times. My perspective and GLAAD's perspective was that we needed to make progress, as you just heard, brick by brick. The principles at stake, that individuals should be treated fairly and without regard to their sexual orientation, whether on the job, at school, or being safe in their community. We needed that basic foundation before we could take on the fight to require the government to recognize our relationships, the source of so much discrimination. And in a modest way, we were trying to apply the lessons of the brilliant work of Thurgood Marshall and his mentor, Charles Hamilton Houston, in gaining civil rights for African Americans. And then came 1993. You know what happened in 1993? It was a pivotal year for GLAAD and for our whole movement. The Hawaii Supreme Court ruled that denying same-sex couples the right to marry was a form of sex discrimination and sent the case to trial for the state to justify that discrimination. I was shocked and amazed, happily so, that a court could see the discrimination. For me, that case was a turning point. I went from saying no to saying yes. That was 22 years ago, and of course I've been saying yes ever since. Now, Dan Foley, the attorney who litigated the case in Hawaii, welcomed Evan Wolfson, then an attorney at Lambda Legal, to his team after that preliminary Hawaii win. A few of us, shockingly few, people like me and Evan, now began frantic efforts to let people know that this case was underway in Hawaii. But it wasn't just about one case anymore. It was about bringing the idea of marriage equality into the overall conversation about equal treatment for gay people. It was about spreading a message that not only should we win, but we really could win there. I traveled to every legal and community group I could for years throughout New England with that message. And I pulled together lawyers from the New England states to start sharing legal information and research. Some people I met in these travels were energized, ecstatic, couldn't wait to get on board. But others were skeptical, afraid, or even angry about bringing this issue to the fore. Why fight for something we can never get, some said. won't we be worse off if we ask for this? Others said, fearing the fury. Some people questioned why we would seek marriage at all, either because they felt our relationships were fine as they were, or because they felt like marriage itself was a problematic institution. Now, I knew achieving marriage equality would be a stretch, but I believed we had to go for it. Same-sex couples had brought marriage cases in the 1970s, and they had been denied licenses at city halls, but taken the courageous step of challenging those denials under the federal constitution. They had been inspired by a case known as Loving versus Virginia, decided by the Supreme Court in 1967. Loving is the best named Supreme Court case ever. It involved a black woman and a white man who fell in love. They couldn't marry in their home state of Virginia, so they went to D.C. They came home. Virginia officials arrested them in the middle of the night, charging them with violating the criminal ban on mixed-race marriages. Only if they would leave Virginia could they escape a penalty of 25 years in jail. A trial judge had held that the state ban was justified based on God's plan of separating the races onto different continents. The Lovings did go to D.C. and to court. The United States Supreme Court unanimously struck down Virginia's law and the laws of 15 other states, holding, number one, that the freedom to marry is one of the vital personal rights of all Americans, part of our liberty protected by the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. And secondly, as a matter of equal protection, states could not deny equal access to marriage based on the race of those who wanted to marry. After Loving, some gay people dared to think, aren't we among the all-Americans that the Supreme Court just said should have this vital personal right? And so same-sex couples filed cases in Minnesota, Washington, and Kentucky, claiming the right to marry under the federal constitution. The state courts treated their claims contemptuously. The United States Supreme Court dismissed outright the Minnesota couple's case as not even stating a question under the federal constitution. That is how entirely other our nation's high court saw gay people and our relationships. But now, in 1993, with this ruling from the Supreme Court, from the Hawaii Supreme Court, I felt we had a new chance and a new generation. Now, the 1993 Hawaii decision also terrified opponents of civil rights for LGBT people. And as part of presidential politics in 1996, these opponents seized on the specter of the Hawaii decision to get Congress to pass the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. DOMA did two things. First, it permitted states to deny recognition to a same-sex couple's valid marriage from another state. Of course, there were no such marriages. And second, it defined marriage for purposes of all federal laws as between a man and a woman. As a consequence, if a state ever did allow same-sex couples to marry, those couples would be considered unmarried as single for purposes of over 1,100 laws where marital status was a factor. I was mad as a hornet. I was thinking, Defense of Marriage Act? This is not a defense, this is an attack. We haven't even won anything yet. I remember being at an anti-DOMA rally at Copley Square in Boston and thinking, GLAAD is going to take this thing down. So the Hawaii case itself died in 1998. Our side won the trial in 1996, but while the case was on appeal, and after the whole right wing moved to Hawaii, the voters amended the state constitution to allow the legislature and not the courts to alter the state's definition of marriage, and the legislature had already done so. The election returns in Hawaii were past my bedtime, so I called Evan the next day, and he told me the grim news. We had lost 70-30. I felt sick. You know, we have DOMA, we have this crushing loss in Hawaii, and I really wondered if this fight was going to be over before we even had the chance to get it started. But for us at GLAAD, the answer was no. We're on it. We got up the next day and brushed ourselves off, and the legal battle and the battle for hearts and minds was on. We started in Vermont. Even before the final notes sounded in Hawaii, I knew we needed a plan B. Fortunately, I was in touch with two amazing attorneys, Beth Robinson and Susan Murray, the de facto leaders of the LGBT community in Vermont. They were already talking with a couple about a case, but Beth and Susan wanted to do it right. And that meant doing extensive statewide education both before and during the case. With a common strategy, GLAAD and Beth and Susan's law firm, Langrock, Sperry & Wohl, filed the first strategically planned marriage case in the country. We had several factors in our favor. Our three plaintiff couples, always our plaintiff couples, are the heart and soul of the case. With a sane amount of trepidation, they bought into our vision of being front and center in the case. The public would get to know them as real people, as neighbors, as parents. We didn't want to have an abstract debate about gay people. We also had a strong constitution in Vermont and an open-minded legislature. The Vermont Supreme Court had interpreted the state's common benefits clause to apply to all members of the community and not limited it to 18th century standards. And as a defensive matter, strategically, the bar for amending the Vermont Constitution was high. If we did win, our opponents would have to win an amendment vote in two consecutive legislatures. So we thought this is a good state to press the liberty, freedom to marry, and equality claim, both of which had prevailed in the Loving case. But we did so under the state constitution. Now, the state of Vermont came back at us with what are now familiar arguments to people who do this work. The fundamental right to marry only applies to different sex couples. Marriage just is, inherently, by definition, a different sex institution, and it's linked to procreation. But for procreation, we wouldn't have marriage. And if same-sex couples marry, how can we put any limits at all on marriage? Now, countering our claim for equal treatment, Vermont offered seven reasons for gay people's exclusion, including that marriage bridges differences between men and women, and that and the possibility of destabilizing marriage altogether if same-sex couples could marry. The trial court, without oral argument, accepted one reason, the notion that the state had an interest in furthering the link between procreation and child-rearing. Up on appeal to the Vermont Supreme Court, we demolished the idea that procreation was the one and only reason for marriage. After all, procreation is not a requirement for marriage for anyone. Why should it be for same-sex couples? People can marry on their deathbed. And if you care about children, then the marriage bar undermines the state's interest in protecting the children and our families. Making arguments we would make over and over again for the next 20 years, I want to quote you something from our brief. There is no basis for the assumption that marriage is a zero-sum game, such that allowing same-sex couples to marry will somehow harm different-sex marriage or result in a decrease in the number of such marriages or the number of heterosexual couples having children. Beth Robinson, and I have to say she's now Justice Beth Robinson, argued the case at the Vermont Supreme Court in November 1998, about 2 weeks after Hawaii had amended its constitution. The pressure was on, and she nailed it. We waited over a year for the decision, and on December 20th, 1999, on the eve of the new millennium, the Vermont Supreme Court ruled in our favor, concluding that denying same-sex couples any sort of legal recognition violated the state common benefits clause. As much as the content of the opinion, I was struck by its tone. Consider this. To acknowledge plaintiffs as Vermonters who want nothing more nor less than protection and security for their commitment to an intimate and lasting human relationship is simply a recognition of their common humanity. I thought, common humanity is exactly right. Here's the wrinkle. The Vermont Supreme Court left the remedy for the constitutional violation to the state legislature. The legislature could either allow same-sex couples to marry, or it could create a parallel system with the same state-based rights, protections, and responsibilities as marriage. Vermont became a big battleground. The House Judiciary Committee, to its enormous credit, heard from experts on both sides from all over the country and hosted several public hearings in Montpelier, most of which coincided with ice storms, to guide its deliberations. Ultimately, the committee opted for a parallel system. And although this caused great agitation in the Vermont Freedom to Marry movement, the advocates decided to make the parallel status the best possible parallel status and get that bill passed. I remember a great deal from Vermont, but I remember this senator standing up and reading a letter he had received from a constituent. I am a 78-year-old mother of eight and grandmother from a Vermont farm family. One of my eight children is gay. Then on learning he was gay, she said, should I cast him out or accept him instantly? God blessed us with our eight children, and God made no mistake when he gave us our gay son. Still, even with that kind of sentiment and sanity, getting the civil union law passed meant crossing a great divide. It meant going from no recognition of same-sex couples and their families to almost marriage. With great courage of many, who I cannot single out here, except for one, openly gay Representative Bill Lippert, who spoke as a gay man on the House floor, the legislature created and passed the first civil union law in the nation in 1990, in March 2000. So same-sex couples were now out of the legal wilderness in one state. We would be civil union partners rather than legal strangers. And thousands of happy people, appreciative people, flocked to Vermont. But it was also bittersweet, especially for the lawyers. Hadn't we, as a nation, overcome the idea of separate but equal? And wasn't a parallel civil union system precisely that for gay people? So Vermont's triumph was also a bridge forward to the future. The concept of civil unions allowed people to think anew about the fairness issues without having to confront marriage. The civil union debate really did call the question as to why people committed and responsible for one another should be treated as nobodies when it mattered in life's challenges and tragedies. But as advocates, we were clear civil unions were not enough and were not the same protection. So in April 2001, GLAAD filed its second marriage case, Goodridge versus Department of Public Health, and we were clear we were seeking marriage, not what they had in Vermont. This might not have seemed like a propitious moment to file the case. By that point, 36 states had already passed laws barring marriage for same-sex couples or any recognition thereof, and four states had already amended their constitutions to the same effect. No political party in Massachusetts favored marriage for same-sex couples. Every single statewide leader, Democrat and Republican alike, opposed us. But we had the Massachusetts Constitution, penned by John Adams and ratified in 1780, declaring that all people are born free and equal and have certain natural, essential, and unalienable rights. And that was our ticket. As in Vermont, we put the plaintiffs at the center of the case with their full consent, and the seven couples in the case became household names, and people got familiar with their stories, which range from the lead plaintiff's daughter asking them if they loved each other, why weren't they married, to the health challenges faced by another couple and the concerns of aging couples entering a more vulnerable phase in their lives. The Commonwealth won the first round, convincing the trial judge that this radical change in a controversial area belonged solely to the legislature and not the courts. On appeal to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, we emphasized the Constitution's vitality and the court's role in deciding when the legislature has drawn a line on the wrong side of the Constitution. Again, the state's lawyers urged the court to stay its hand, but we emphasize how passing the buck to the legislature would have harms and consequences to people and children right now. As I wrote in our brief to the court in 2002, the right to marry the person you love and with whom you share your life is one of the most fundamental of all of our human and civil rights. The desire to marry is grounded in the intangibles of love, an enduring commitment, and a shared journey through life. Take a break. Given that all that marriage is and represents, the brief continued, denying marriage is a denial of the equal citizenship of gay and lesbian people who make their homes and communities across this commonwealth and enshrines a second-class status upon the plaintiffs, their families, and children. We also gave a great deal of attention to amici in this case, known as Friends of the Court, and reached out to experts who could offer their own insights to the justices as they grappled with these questions. So, for example, the notion that regulating heterosexual procreation was the state's interest for creating government-regulated marriage. We had contested that, of course, but it couldn't really hurt if the well-respected authors of the family law treatise in the state also put forth that view in a brief. And Friend of the Court briefs came in from state constitutional law scholars, social workers and pediatricians about child outcomes, civil rights groups naming the exclusion as discrimination, historians of marriage and the family pointing to the profound changes in marriage over time, and both the Massachusetts and Boston Bar Associations. Almost all of these briefs were authored by leading law firms. This was an unprecedented show of support for marriage. On the morning of oral argument on March 4, 2003, I began, "The plaintiffs stand before this court seeking nothing more and nothing less than the same respect under our laws and Constitution as all other people enjoy, the same liberty to marry the person of their choice, and the same equal right to marry on the terms applied to other people. Love and commitment infuses the relationships of these seven couples, but they are locked out of a precious right." We waited over 8 months for the decision, and then finally on November 18, 2003, the court, in a majority opinion authored by Chief Justice Margaret H. Marshall, a name never to be forgotten, broke the historic barrier with this statement: "Marriage is a vital social institution. The exclusive commitment of two individuals to each other nurtures love and mutual support. It brings stability to our society. The Massachusetts Constitution affirms the dignity and equality of all individuals. It forbids the creation of second-class citizens. The Commonwealth has failed to identify any constitutionally adequate reason for denying civil marriage to these couples." It was a 4-3 ruling. It was a home run on equality and liberty. The bar was broken. After skimming the opinion at the court, I ran back to my office to discover that the Associated Press had put out a story to wire outlets all over the world, reporting that we had won civil unions, but not marriage. Reporters were understandably clamoring for clarification. At our mobbed news conference with our plaintiffs on stage, I was firm. Yes, we had won marriage. Yes, there was a 6-month delay before the ruling would go into effect, but that was simply to allow the legislature to adjust any laws necessary and local officials to get their paperwork in order. In our view, civil unions were not on the table in Massachusetts. There were 4 lawsuits to thwart or undo the Goodridge ruling, and the last wound its way to the U.S. Supreme Court for emergency review and was not decided until the Friday before marriages were to begin on Monday morning, May 17, 2004. We got there. We also had to face a constitutional convention convened by the legislature to consider an amendment to the Constitution to ban marriage for same-sex couples. What transpired the first day of the convention and for the next 2 months was raucous, with both sides fully engaged. Legislators heard from more constituents on this issue than ever before. And there were many unforgettable moments. A newly elected Republican legislator speaking out for his lesbian colleague, saying she deserved 100% of her constitutional rights. A conservative Democrat, who I'd often been on the other side of, with strong ties to the Catholic Church, rising to say the decision was beyond her comfort level, but her comfort level was not the measure of her constituents' constitutional rights. Despite the State House debates that would continue for 3 more years, May 17, 2004 arrived, bringing the first legal marriages of same-sex couples in this nation. What would happen, people wondered, as the day approached. We got the answer when the marriages started. There was an outbreak of joy and happiness. You could almost feel the temperature drop. People were witnessing something familiar. They saw loving couples making that special and unique commitment that is marriage. As one of our stalwart legislative friends, Byron Rushing, said, the best argument for gay marriage is gay marriage. The Goodridge decision stood alone for 5 long years as a beacon of equality that lifted the dignity and aspirations of LGBT people and many others. To this day, I still meet people who tell me where they were when they heard about the decision. But there were always storm clouds. In the 2004 presidential race, President Bush squared off for re-election against Massachusetts Senator John Kerry. On election day, 11 states passed constitutional amendments banning marriage for same-sex couples and more. 10 of these, of course, already had statutory bans in place, so they were doubling down. And then the media began claiming that gay marriage had cost Senator Kerry the election. Now, that is likely urban legend, since people who slice and dice these things for a living say it was the war, terrorism, and the economy that were motivating people, all of which favored the incumbent president, George W. Bush. But those media stories certainly made our road forward more difficult. Thankfully, we got a huge boost from a man named Tim Gill, a successful software developer who decided to invest in the LGBT community with strategic giving. Tim was alarmed by the developments he saw with the constitutional amendments, and he brought people together in Denver in 2004 to talk about the state of play. Then at Tim's request, about a dozen of us met in New Jersey for 2 days in 2005, talking about going forward. It was difficult and intense. Other than defending the victory in Massachusetts, there was little agreement. Should we work for marriage, for civil unions, or as some people advocated, should we just drop the whole subject and talk about something else? We decided, as a thought experiment, to imagine a future Supreme Court ruling winning on marriage equality and conceptualize what would need to be in place for the court to play its role as final arbiter in our system. We knew the pattern for other landmark victories. So at the time of Loving versus Virginia, there were 16 states that still barred interracial marriage. At the time of Brown versus Board of Education, 17 states mandated separate schools based on race. At the time of Lawrence versus Texas, when the Supreme Court invalidated laws criminalizing certain types of sexual intimacy under the federal constitution, there were only 13 states with such laws on the books. It was clear the Supreme Court was not a consensus builder, but a consensus confirmer, and it would not get out too far ahead of the states. But given the number of state statutes and amendments already in place, with clearly more coming, we knew we could not rely on getting to a supermajority of states to recognize marriage in anyone's lifetime. But perhaps there was another way to create the conditions for the Supreme Court to play that role. Our discussion led to a rough plan of building a supermajority group of positive leaning states. So we would continue trying to win marriage equality in some states. We would aim for civil unions or domestic partnership in others. And finally, in a third category, we would seek more modest protections. We brainstorm which states might roughly fit into what category. And it was clear we had at least 30 states, a majority. This strategy confirmed a truce. It allowed all of us to continue the work that we thought was important and work in different lanes. And we could move forward. And by the way, at that time in 2005, we thought this would take us 15 to 25 years, that is to 2020 or 2030. We had reasons not to be overly optimistic. The marriage fight was going badly. We had lost cases in the high courts of Maryland, New York, and Washington in 2005 and 2006. New Jersey managed to provide civil unions in 2006. Professor Riggins tells me that one of her classes in 2006, they were simply not buying the idea that we were going to win marriage equality and thought it would be at least 40 years. Our opponents were gleeful and gloating at this time. Yes, Massachusetts was a thorn in their side, but they assumed they would still soon kill us off with a marriage amendment there, and then they could lock down the rest of the country with amendments. They were even proposing and pursuing an amendment to the United States Constitution to ban marriage, and that would require us to hold 13 states. Some of us thought we could win that fight if necessary, but the prospect of such a fight was horrifying. Yet, in June 2007, with the passionate commitment of a great many people, including leadership from Governor Deval Patrick of Massachusetts, the Massachusetts legislature defeated a Second Amendment, a citizen-initiated proposal to ban marriage for same-sex couples. We had over three-quarters of the legislature on our side, and the threat was over. Now we had not only that beacon of equality, we had an anchor in the ground. And that final victory meant our opponents were wrong, that Massachusetts was going to be a short-lived social experiment. Even more importantly, it was a turning point that changed the national dynamic. The following year, coincidentally, two state courts ruled in favor of marriage equality under their state constitutions, California in June, Connecticut in October, Connecticut being another of Glad's cases. Among other things, both opinions ruled that separate systems of recognition did not provide equal treatment under law. Then in 2009, Iowa's Supreme Court unanimously ruled in favor of marriage. We were also on the move legislatively, as three New England states, after lots of work by lots of people, gave us the first ever legislative wins on marriage. In 2009, the Vermont legislature voted in favor of marriage equality, dramatically overriding a governor's veto. And then Maine and New Hampshire followed suit. Now we were not just winning in courts, but with the people's representatives, another milestone. So far, my story has taken you through many states, courts, and legislatures, but now there's a second and connected part of the story, the fight in federal court under the federal Constitution. So the story starts with a case filed by GLAAD in March 2009, the first case to challenge the Federal Defense of Marriage Act on behalf of couples legally married in their state of residence. This is Gill versus Office of Personnel Management. Remember that part of DOMA provided the federal government would not treat a married same-sex couple as married. We thought there was a simple equal protection claim here. DOMA's definition created two classes of married people. One group was treated as married for all purposes. The other were treated as single. But we don't have classes of married people in this country. And what rationale could there be for such selectivity and colossal disadvantaging? There was a lot of fear, I will tell you also, among my legal advocate friends about raising these issues in federal court. Up to this point, we had focused on states based on analysis of state constitutions, offensive and defensive. But raising a claim under the federal constitution meant the U.S. Supreme Court was the last stop, and the stakes could not be higher, making a national rule. So we built a team mindful of where we were headed. We involved Paul Smith, who had argued Lawrence versus Texas, before the Supreme Court, and Luke Platzer, attorneys at Jenner and Block Supreme Court practice, as well as the Boston law firms of Foley Hoag and Sullivan and Worcester. We also wanted to use the case to educate people about the practical and harmful impacts of DOMA. So we highlighted big federal programs like federal employee workplace benefits, income taxes, Social Security, that everyone would understand. Plaintiff Herb Burtis, for example, met his spouse, John Ferris, at age 18 and never parted from him until death 60 years later. But Herb was denied Social Security benefits for surviving spouses after a lifetime of working and paying into the system, and exactly when he needed it most. Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley also filed a suit against DOMA on behalf of the Commonwealth, arguing that DOMA disrespected the state's validly licensed marriages. This was a very important contribution to the overall effort. Some of our colleagues also worry that a DOMA challenge would seem indistinguishable to the courts from a challenge to state marriage bans themselves. The latter would have been an even bigger lift, but we felt confident that focusing on people who were already, in fact, married by their states and who were being mistreated by the federal government would keep the courts focused on that more narrow issue. Our goal was to take down DOMA, get people the protections they were due, and establish a federal precedent of equal protection for our marriages and our families. And in July 2010, both we and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts won our cases, the first federal district court rulings to strike down DOMA. But as with all social movements, there are ups and downs. 2 years earlier, in November 2008, California voters had passed Proposition 8, amending their state constitution to undo the California Supreme Court's marriage ruling. The supporters of Proposition 8 used a new narrative to move voters. Well, it's true, of course, some voters didn't like gay people. That was not enough to win anymore because many California voters didn't want to stand in the way of somebody else's happiness. So a man named Frank Schubert, a lead supporter of Proposition 8, came up with a new plan. Opponents of marriage equality had to make it seem as though lots of other people would be harmed if same-sex couples married. How do you do that? They argued that marriage for same-sex couples would hurt children by forcing elementary schools to present homosexuality as a norm. It worked. We lost the vote of parents with children under age 18 in the home by a significant margin. Stung from the loss on Proposition 8, a man named Chad Griffin, a public relations and political consultant, and who is now the head of the Human Rights Campaign, spearheaded a lawsuit and a public relations effort. They enlisted as co-counsel attorneys Ted Olson, a conservative Republican and former Solicitor General, and David Boies, the attorney that Mr. Olson had squared off against in Bush versus Gore. In May 2009, about 2 months after we'd filed our DOMA case, they filed their case challenging Proposition 8 called Perry versus Hollingsworth. Olson and Boies explained they would use Proposition 8 as a vehicle to win marriage for everyone across the country by going to the Supreme Court within a year's time. You may or may not be surprised to learn that this case was controversial. The opponents hated it, in part because of one of the things I appreciate about Ted Olson. He made what he called the conservative case for gay marriage, and he stuck up for gay Americans. But proponents of marriage equality had concerns as well. As a strategic matter, we worried whether the Supreme Court was ready to tell 45 states that their amendments and statutes banning marriage were unconstitutional. Of course, we were heading for that goal ourselves, but we were planning some additional steps along the way, like taking down DOMA. So GLAAD decided to do everything we could to create the best possible circumstances if the court was going to get a case that early. D.C. and New York passed marriage through legislative channels, making New York the sixth state with marriage. And we began a campaign in Maine to reverse the painful referendum loss we had suffered in 2009. The 2009 campaign had been led exquisitely by Jesse Connolly, the same Jesse who led our 2005 non-discrimination campaign and whose father had introduced the non-discrimination law in the 1970s. We had to show in Maine that people could change their minds and win at the ballot box. In the meantime, we kept the cases coming. Glad filed a second DOMA lawsuit in Connecticut on behalf of people from New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Vermont, and the Perry team won their first round on Proposition 8. We also learned that the now justifiably famous Edie Windsor planned on filing a case in New York City challenging DOMA because Edie had been forced to pay a $363,000 state tax bill she would never have had to pay if her deceased spouse was a man. The lawyers in all the DOMA cases coordinated with one another. We wanted the Connecticut and New York cases to go up to the Second Circuit together. And the Second Circuit, this is the court that hears appeals from Vermont and Connecticut and New York, offered us a critical opportunity. This was one of the few courts in the country that had not already decided a critical legal issue. That is, whether close judicial review is required for laws that distinguish among people based on their sexual orientation. Are such laws that distinguish, are they going to be presumed constitutional, which is not close review? Or are they the kinds of laws that are more likely to reflect impermissible prejudice? If the court required close scrutiny, we were even in a stronger position to win. One of the most remarkable moments in my professional career happened in February 2011, when our legal team and the Connecticut case and the Windsor team received a call from the Justice Department, the United States Justice Department. We had been making the case to them for some time that close scrutiny was required in the Second Circuit and that DOMA was clearly unconstitutional. On the call that day, they told us they agreed that the President and the Attorney General had decided DOMA was unconstitutional and that heightened scrutiny, close scrutiny, should apply. They would no longer defend DOMA in court. That is not a call you get every day. Fast forwarding, if I may, activity was continuing in the states, and Maine made a critical contribution, not only to the citizens here, but to the national effort in November 2012, when Maine became the seventh state to adopt marriage equality, the first to do so at the ballot, and show the world people can change their minds. Maryland and Washington were after us. So they were 8-9. And in Minnesota, for the first time, we defeated a proposed constitutional amendment to ban same-sex couples from marrying. It was a rather phenomenal election night, especially when you think back to election nights like 1998 or 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. Less than a month later, the attention shifted back to the courts. The Supreme Court granted review in the New York Windsor case on DOMA and in the Perry case, in which the lawyers were seeking to get to marriage nationwide. The Windsor case thus became our vehicle for challenging DOMA before the Supreme Court. We at GLAAD continued our close working relationship with Edie Windsor's attorney, the incredible Robbie Kaplan, and with the other legal groups backing the case. At Robbie's request, GLAAD rolled up its sleeves to coordinate the amici filings, and we helped the Perry team with that effort as well. And as you all know, we won. The Supreme Court's ruling on June 26, 2013 was pretty thrilling. The court ruled 5-4, DOMA is unconstitutional. It concluded that states providing marriage conferred a lawful status on lawful conduct, as well as a status and dignity of immense import when it provided marriage. States that allowed same-sex couples to marry were recognizing the intimacy and the bond of those couples. In contrast, the essence of DOMA was interference with the equal dignity of these marriages. The federal discrimination imposed a disadvantage, a separate status, and a stigma. It denied such couples both benefits and responsibilities, creating financial penalties and insecurity. DOMA also demeaned such couples whose moral and sexual choices the Constitution respects. and created second-tier marriages that violated the federal Constitution. I will say, from saying yes to this issue in 1993, when I first thought this was one we should fight, to 20 years later and reading those decisions, can I just say it was incredible. In addition, the Supreme Court that day made a ruling in the Proposition 8 case that restored marriage equality to California, making it the 12th state with marriage equality. While the court did not reach the underlying constitutional question because it ruled that the case was not properly before it for procedural reasons, the final result was an incredible victory nonetheless. The case below had put Proposition 8 on trial, serving as a truth commission of sorts, and had spread a vision of marriage as crossing party lines. Of course, a ruling that DOMA was unconstitutional did not mean marriage equality now existed across the country, but it served precisely the purpose it was intended to serve, as a stepping stone toward that final outcome. A state's denying marriage now looked a lot like the denial of protections as set forth in DOMA. The stakes were clearer to everyone. States that denied marriage were denying us so much in terms of personhood, citizenship, and protection far beyond government benefits. And the justifications advanced for DOMA were the same arguments being made against marriage equality. People were on fire. They had no interest in waiting any longer. A wave of lawsuits followed the Windsor decision, ultimately over 100 in states across the country. At the same time, the federal government was vigorously implementing the Windsor decision nationwide. It decided, consistent with law, to respect marriages of same-sex couples, with a few exceptions, even if the state where the couple lived did not itself respect those marriages for state purposes. That put a further spotlight on the state still engaging in marriage discrimination. The end of the road was clearly coming. We could see, we hoped, the final goalpost. Wins in marriage equality cases began coming in across the country from places like Utah, Oklahoma, Virginia, Wisconsin, Indiana, Idaho, and then the courts of appeals in those jurisdictions upheld the lower court rulings. The states sought review in the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Supreme Court denied review, leaving those positive decisions intact. But once there was an appellate ruling the other way, against marriage equality, the Supreme Court accepted review. The appellate decision by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals covered cases that had arisen in Ohio, Michigan, Tennessee, and Kentucky. Some of the cases raised a direct challenge to marriage inequality, while others just raised the question of whether states could choose to recognize valid marriages or not. Obviously, if we won the first question, the second would become blessedly moot. So here we were, finally before the Supreme Court. There were many cases in the mix, many excellent lawyers who've been pouring their hearts and souls into winning these cases. I had been helping in Michigan since they had asked for GLAAD's help in the fall of 2013. To my surprise, I was picked as the oralist on the cases raising the fundamental issue of the right to marry. I got that nod less than a month out from the argument. My first Supreme Court argument. But as people said to me, "Ah, Mary, you've been preparing for this for 20 years." And that's kind of true. April 28th, 2015, argument day came quickly. I had done everything I could to prepare. Thank you again to my family. Reading, conferring, practice arguments, more practice arguments, more Q&A, and I knew people had my back. The collaboration also among a small group of counsel involved in these cases was like none I had ever experienced. And I carried with me, as I always do, the stories of the thousands of people who I've talked to about this issue over the years. I also carried with me the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. When our country ratified the 14th Amendment, they did not think that it would invalidate interracial marriages or race-segregated schools, but our Supreme Court correctly ruled that it does. Likewise, they did not think it would change laws distinguishing based on gender, but 100-plus years after it was ratified, the court said, it does. It's not the words of the Constitution that have changed, but our understanding of equality has. And as I said when we began, quoting Justice Ginsburg, the history of our Constitution is the story of extending constitutional protections to those once ignored or excluded. And now we are looking forward. On June 26, 2015, the U.S. Supreme Court made it possible for same-sex couples to marry the person they love anywhere in this country. And we all did that. We all did that. Millions of people helped to make this happen. And I must say that this is the fourth Supreme Court ruling in 20 years saying, stop treating gay people and same-sex couples differently from others. My hope is that the memo has gone out. But will all the prejudice and stereotypes about LGBT people disappear now anymore than stereotypes disappeared after the rulings in Loving and Brown? Of course not. We must continue standing up for justice. We must make fair treatment the norm across the country and across an LGBT person's lifetime, from cradle to grave, whether they are married or unmarried, middle class or struggling, of whatever color, transgender or not. We need a national standard of justice achieved in courts, in the Congress, and in the states. I hope and assume that you in the audience have other goals that you're seeking to achieve. So let me just close with a few thoughts about public service. Number one, we made the progress we did for many reasons, including that we were tenacious but not obstinate. We were patient but not too patient. And we were optimistic but also realistic. We spoke, but we also listened a lot. We stayed on the high road rather than vilify our detractors. We worked hard on all levels, from the grassroots to the state house and ballot box, and ultimately to the Supreme Court. None of our victories were inevitable. There is no inexorable arc of progress. There is no formula, no guarantee of success. And we will have to fight hard to keep these gains. As Frederick Douglass famously said, there is no progress without struggle. Lots of it. Second, I am extremely grateful to have a law degree that has enabled me to work for goals I believe in and to lift up our nation's promises of equality and liberty for all. It's taken me to courtrooms for sure, but also to legislative committee hearings, to advocacy meetings, to political campaigns. I've litigated, and I've also thought hard about connecting with the public and engaging the legislative process, the administrative process, the ballot process. Our fight has been visible of late, but we are here at the Coffin Lecture to remember that less visible efforts are just as vital, ensuring that the poor and disenfranchised get a fair shake, welcoming our new Mainers. Schools and universities matter in the here and now, and for a better future, they must have sufficient resources to educate. Working inside and outside the government, so our society enforces the law, protects consumers, the elderly, children, those without resources. These are all essential aspects of public service. All of us, lawyers or not, especially if we're not, can play key roles in this work, which is nothing less than building and maintaining our beloved community here in Maine and beyond. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. The speaker was Mary Bonato, Civil Rights Project Director at GLAAD, who has been at the center of the movement towards same-sex marriage in America for more than two decades. Earlier this year, Bonato successfully argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in the historic case establishing the freedom to marry for same-sex couples nationwide. This program was edited for length, and the whole program can be heard on our website, mpbn.net, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on MPBN Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.